This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Wolf Hunter River by Rachel Kane. Performed by Lauren Ezzo, Will Ropp, Emily Sutton Smith, and Dan John Miller.
Prologue. 4 days ago. When Ellie White's teacher, Mrs. Willingham, told her that her driver was coming early to pick her up from school, Ellie knew it wasn't the whole truth. Mr. Liu never came early to get her, not unless she was sick. Why? She asked. She liked asking questions when things didn't make sense. She might only be six, but Daddy had taught her to ask if she didn't understand. Mama had been a little embarrassed by how much she had taken to it. I'm afraid that your daddy asked him to, Mrs. Willingham said. She was a nice, white lady with a streak of gray in her brown hair, and she was a good teacher. She never treated Ellie any different from the others, even though Ellie's father had a lot of money. Even though Ellie had dark brown skin, darker than any of the other girls here, who mostly looked as white as magazine pages.
Daddy doesn't do that, Ellie said.
Something's wrong. Mrs. Willingham was looking at her, but not at her. Well, your mama got sick, she said. So he's sending a car to come get you and take you to the hospital where he and your mama are, okay? She helped Ellie put on her sweater, which Ellie didn't like to wear but didn't want to leave behind either. Then her backpack.
Mrs. Willingham?
Ellie asked. She looked up at her teacher.
Are you crying?
No, sweetie, I'm just fine. Come on now, let's get you out there, he's waiting.
But Daddy said the code word?
He said the code word, Mrs. Willingham said. The code is Blackbird today, right? Ellie nodded. Thursday was Blackbird. Every day was a bird of some kind, because she liked birds, and Mama always called her Little Hummingbird because she darted around so fast. But Sunday was Hummingbird. Mrs. Willingham went down the school steps first to talk to Mr. Liu, who was waiting inside the car on the loop that went between the steps and the big marble fountain. The rule was that Ellie was never to come to the car until Mrs. Willingham said it was okay. She and Mr. Liu were talking a long time. Mrs. Willingham kept crying. It was hot today and humid, but the fountain always looked so cool and pretty. The water sprayed out of a bunch of concrete shells into a bigger shell in the middle. Mama had told her there had once been a pretty lady in the shell, but some parents had made the school take her out, so she was off in some storage closet now, which was sad. Mrs. Willingham came back up the steps to take her hand. Ellie looked up at her.
Everything's gonna be all right, her teacher said, but her voice shook. Her eyes were red. I'm sorry, baby, but I have to do this. I have a family, too.
Ellie felt sorry for her.
Is your family okay, Mrs. Willingham?
She didn't mean to make the lady cry.
Yes, Ellie, they're gonna be okay. Can you help me make sure they are?
Ellie wasn't sure how to do that, but she nodded anyway. She liked to help, even if she wasn't really sure why Mrs. Willingham thought she could. Mrs. Willingham opened the door and boosted Ellie up, which was Mr. Liu's job usually. Then her teacher hugged her.
You stay strong, Ellie. You're gonna be okay.
But what about your family?
Ellie asked.
Aren't you coming with me so we can help them?
Mrs. Willingham covered her mouth, and tears rolled down her cheeks, and she just shook her head. She shut the door, and that was when Ellie knew something was really wrong. Mrs. Willingham had just lied to her, but she didn't know why. And then she realized it was worse than she thought, because this looked like the right car, but it didn't smell like the car usually smelled, which was a little bit like coconut, her favorite.
Mr. Liu,
she called toward the driver. The lock engaged with a heavy thunk. She could see him up in the front seat, a big man wearing a cap. She felt smaller than usual in the back seat, and as the car started to move, she quickly buckled herself up. Mr. Liu never started moving until she was buckled in.
Mr. Liu, what's wrong with Mama? Mrs. Willingham said...
She stopped her questions, because the man driving wasn't Mr. Liu. The eyes looking at her in the rearview mirror weren't his.
Put your seatbelt on,
he said. Not Mr. Liu's voice. And Mr. Liu would have said, please.
I did already,
she said. She was scared, but she wasn't going to show it.
Do you know the code word?
Blackbird,
he said.
Isn't that right?
Who are you?
I'm somebody who's going to get you somewhere safe,
he said.
Just like Mr. Liu would want me to do, all right?
I'm calling my daddy,
Ellie said, and unzipped her backpack to pull out her cell phone. It wasn't where she kept it. She knew better than to leave her phone somewhere. It was expensive and important, and she always put it there in that pocket. She felt tears well up and wouldn't let herself cry. They'd want her to cry, whoever took her phone. Whoever was playing this nasty game.
Who are you?
Nobody,
the driver said.
Now sit there and be quiet.
He turned the SUV onto a main road. She tried to watch where they were going, but quickly lost track. She never had to pay attention to that before. The school disappeared over a hill, and he made more turns, and she didn't know where they were at all. She didn't know what to do. Daddy had always told her there were bad people, and she shouldn't go with them if they didn't know the code word. But he did know the code word, and she couldn't push emergency if there wasn't a phone.
Let me out,
she said. She tried to make it sound like her mama would have, cool and confident.
You can stop up here.
Shut up,
the driver said.
Keep quiet. You start making a racket and I'll tape your damn mouth shut.
That scared her even more than being in a strange car and not having her phone. But she wasn't going to show him that. She wasn't going to cry. She looked around and tried to think what else to do. The door wouldn't open. Neither would the window. The SUV had dark-tinted windows, same as Mr. Liu's car. They were to keep the sun out. But they also made it so people couldn't see in. Ellie realized something awful. She was a shadow inside a black car behind tinted windows. No one could see her, and she didn't know what to do next. When she started to scream for help at passing cars, the driver took an exit, parked under a bridge among the cool green trees, and put tape over her mouth and around her legs and arms. Then he carried her around to the back of the SUV. It was empty except for a sleeping bag, one with Disney princesses on it. She was screaming underneath the tape and wiggling and trying to get free, but he put her on top of the sleeping bag and shook his head.
Go to sleep,
he told her, and wiped sweat off his face.
We've got a long way to go. You mind your manners, and I'll feed you in a few hours. You'll be home in a couple of days with a real good story to tell.
Daddy had always told her, if bad people get you, don't believe what they tell you. She didn't believe they'd take her home at all. She got really scared when her nose started to get snotty and it was hard to breathe with the tape over her mouth, so she made herself stop and breathe, slow and regular. She was still scared, but she felt exhausted too, and she finally just closed her eyes and tried to pretend she was somewhere else, back home with her mama. She pretended so hard that she fell asleep, curled up in her mama's lap. And when she woke up, she wanted to tell him she needed to pee, really bad. But he was talking on his phone, and they were in the dark, in a forest. He saw her sit up. He turned around. And she saw through the front windshield the turn ahead and the lights that were coming around it. The lights that were heading straight at them. She tried to scream at him to tell him to watch out for the other car, but he just frowned at her and said,
"I told you to shut."
And then the other car hit them, and everything rolled and crashed, and she thought she heard the man screaming. "Help me," Ellie wanted to say, but she was too scared and too hurt. And then the man stopped screaming, and there wasn't any sound at all.
Chapter 1. Gwen. The wide, dark eye of the television camera reminds me of bad things. Very bad things. I try really hard to keep in mind why I'm sitting here. I'm here to tell my story, frankly and honestly. Because other people have been telling it for far too long now, lying about me and my kids. It's been all over the news for months now. Escaped serial killer abducts X. Shootout in murder house. It's always written for maximum ghoulish effect, and contains at least a passing mention that I was arrested as his accomplice. Sometimes, they remember to say that I was acquitted. Mostly, they like to forget that detail. There have been 100 reporters swamping my email to the point that I just shut it down and ignored it. At least half of them have made the long trip to Stillhouse Lake to try to get me to open the door and tell my side. But I'm not stupid enough to do it without knowing what I'm getting into first. This television appearance took almost a month of negotiations, of guarantees of what I will and won't be asked. I chose the Howie Hamlin show because he has a good reputation. He's been sympathetic to other crime victims and an advocate for justice. But as I take my seat in the interview chair, I'm still feeling unready. I didn't expect this rising level of panic, or to feel burning sweat on the back of my neck. The chair is too deep, and I feel fragile perched on the edge of it. It's the camera. I thought I was past this, but I'm not. Maybe I never will be. The camera keeps staring. Everyone else is so relaxed. The camera operator, just the one, is chatting with someone else, nowhere near the machine and its unblinking eye. The host of the show is conferring with someone off stage in the dimly lit and cable-tangled distance. But I feel pinned in place. And every time I blink, I see that other camera. The one set up on a tripod in a ruined plantation house in Louisiana. I see my ex and his horrible smile. I see blood. Ignore it. This place is smaller than I expected. The stage consists of a short riser and 3 armchairs spaced around with a small, glossy table for accent. The table holds a couple of books, but I'm too nervous to study them. I wonder why 3 chairs. Are there always 3 chairs? I don't know. I can't remember, even though I watched this show beforehand to learn what to expect. You can do this, I tell myself. And practice deep breathing. You faced down not one, but 2 serial killers. This is nothing. It's just an interview. And you're doing this for the kids, to make them safer. Because if I let the media tell the story without me, they're only going to make it worse. Doesn't help. I still want to bolt out of this place and never come back. The only thing that holds me in place is the sight of my kids, Lanny and Connor, watching from the green room. It's a worn waiting area with a soundproof window to the studio so the people inside can watch the action. Lanny gives me an excited thumbs up. I manage a smile somehow. I'm sweating my makeup off, I know it. I'm so unused to wearing it now that it feels like a layer of latex paint smothering me. I flinch at a touch on my shoulder, and when I turn, there's a bearded guy in a ball cap with something in his hand. I nearly hit him. Then I realize it's just a small microphone with a long cord attached. I'm going to hand this to you. You run it under your shirt and clip it on your collar, okay? He says. I guess he sees how jumpy I am, because he takes a step back. I shove the tiny mic under the hem of my blouse and take it up to where it's supposed to be. He nods when I get it into position, then drops a battery pack behind me in the chair. "Okay, you're live," he says. I reply with a thanks I don't feel. The wire feels cold against my bare skin. I wonder if the microphone can pick up my shallow, rapid breathing. I fiddle with the placement just to be sure. 2 minutes, someone out in the darkness says, and I jerk upright. The host is still lingering off stage. I feel deeply alone and exposed. The lights blaze on, blinding me. I have to resist the urge to put up my hand to block the glare. I lace my fingers together to keep myself from fidgeting. At the 1 minute mark, the host steps up on the riser. He's a solidly built, middle-aged white man, dark hair going silver at the temples. He's wearing a nice dark blue suit, and I immediately wonder if I'm underdressed or overdressed. This is not me. I don't care about these things, usually. But then, I've never been live for a TV audience before either. Not of my own volition, anyway. "Hey, Gwen, how are you?" he says, and we shake hands. His feels warm against my ice-cold fingers. "Listen, don't worry about anything. I know this is nerve-wracking, but we'll get you through it, okay? Just trust me. I've got you covered." I nod. I have no choice at this point. He has a warm smile, the same temperature as his hands. It's all a normal day at work to him. I try another deep breath. 30 seconds crawl by, and then there's a countdown. The last 3 counts are silent hand signals, and then the host's smile lights up on cue. He leans a bit forward toward the camera. "Hello, and welcome to this extraordinary episode of Howie Hamlin. Now, we'll be covering later in the program the shocking ongoing case of the abduction of little Ellie White. But before that, we'll have an in-depth discussion of the case everyone has been talking about, Melvin Royal. There's been one very important voice missing from this media clamor, and we're so lucky to have her with us today. Gwen Proctor, or as she was previously known, Gina Royal. Gina Royal was the wife of the infamous serial killer Melvin Royal, who was recently shot dead in Louisiana during what can only be described as an unbelievably brutal attack on his... I can't stand it. I interrupt him. X, I say, and bring Howie Hamlin to a sudden halt in his polished intro. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I'm his ex-wife. I divorced him a long time ago. He takes a brief beat and says, "Yes, yes, of course, you're quite right, and that is my mistake. He was your ex-husband at the time this shocking incident occurred. So you'd like to be called Gwen Proctor now, not Gina Royal, is that correct?" "That's my legal name. I've had it changed officially, as well as the names of my children. Gina Royal no longer exists. She barely existed in the first place, looking back on it." "Of course. So Gwen, just to make sure our viewing audience is caught up on this incredible tale, when Melvin Royal was initially caught several years ago with a young woman's body still in the house you shared with him, you were also accused of helping him in his abductions. Is that correct?" "Yes," I say. "I was acquitted." "So you were," he sounds smoothingly approving. "But after that, you went on the run, changing your name and location multiple times. Why do that if you were innocent?" I have a vibe now, and I don't like it. Something's off. I sense this isn't going to be the softball interview I was promised. "I am innocent, but there were death threats being delivered to me and my kids on a daily basis. Internet harassment and threats of rape and violence constantly. I did what was necessary to protect my family." I don't mention that Melvin kept finding us too, sending letters. That's a can of vipers I don't want to open.
"Didn't you go to the police?"
"The police are always reluctant to act on anonymous threats, which is an issue those with stalkers know all too well. I chose to take actions to be sure my kids were safe."
"I see. But why keep on moving, then?" Because one thing internet trolls are really good at doing is working together to find people and victimize them all over again. It's a game for many of them. I didn't realize it in the beginning, but my harassment was a highly organized effort. It still is, I'm certain.
Then why are you here, taking that risk?
I pause. I want to get this right. Because it happens every day. Not just to celebrities or people like me who've drawn attention. It happens to ordinary people, even to children. And our laws and our law enforcement haven't adjusted to deal with this problem at all. But I'm not here to save the world. Just my kids.
From what, exactly?
Misinformation, I say. Lies that take hold and gin up more outrage, more harassment. So I want to tell my story. Even saying that makes me shake inside. I've spent so much time running. This is, in many ways, the hardest thing I've done, being so vulnerable.
The floor is yours, Howie says. That's why we've given you this time.
So I do. I tell him about marrying my ex, about our early life when I had no clue that the demands he placed on me in the home, in our bedroom, were anything but normal. I was too young and too sheltered to know better. I'd been told to be sweet, be accommodating, be what my husband expected from me. And once the kids came, it was too late to listen to my instincts. I was too afraid to look at the truth. Until the truth crashed into Melvin's workshop, the one he never let me enter, in the form of a drunk driver. That was the day Melvin's gruesome, cruel handiwork first saw the light of day. When I go silent there, remembering that moment and fighting that memory, Hamlin leans forward.
Gwen, let's get right to the point here. You had to know, didn't you? How could he bring these young women into your home and you not know?
I tried to explain about his locked workshop, his night owl hours. Hamlin pretends to listen, but I can see he's just waiting for me to finish. When I do, he says,
"You understand why many, many people doubt your story, don't you? They simply can't imagine that you slept side by side with a killer and never had a clue."
"Ask Ted Bundy's girlfriend," I say. "Ask Gary Ridgway's wife. Ask Dennis Rader's entire family. There might have been signs, but I couldn't recognize them for what they were. I never imagined he was doing these things, or I would have tried to stop him."
"Tried?" Hamlin repeats.
"He'd have killed me," I say. "And he'd have had our children to do with as he pleased. I can't even imagine what that would have been, and I don't want to. I survived, Mr. Hamlin. I did that for my children, and I will keep doing it, no matter what comes." I'm fairly happy with the way I've phrased it. But I'm on guard now. Why is he pushing me? This isn't what we agreed on. He's supposed to be helping me, not interrogating me.
"Let's go back to your husband, Melvin Royal. He continued to pursue you even while he was behind bars. That was your claim, wasn't it? Part of your harassment? Surely that part had nothing to do with faceless strangers on the internet."
"Claim." I nearly snap at him. I feel like a prisoner in this chair, and I hate the feeling. I can't glance at the camera, but I know it's staring. The red, on-air light is a smear in my peripheral vision. I try to focus on Hamlin's face, but it's a blur. I keep seeing people moving around me, and I hate it. Hate it. I don't like people sneaking up on me.
"Gwen?"
I realize that I'm staring at him with a blank expression, and I try to remember the question. "Melvin. He's talking about Melvin." "My husband sent me letters," I tell him. "Someone inside the prison smuggled them out for him. We now think he's scattered them all over the country for people to send, even posthumously. There's still an investigation underway into that, as far as I know."
"And did you keep these letters? Show them to prison officials? The police?"
"The first ones," I say. My throat feels dry. My fingers twitch. "But he was already on death row. There wasn't a lot they could do to punish him."
"Hmm."
He draws it out, and he's assumed a thoughtful expression. And you have records of all of these internet threats you say you received? Why is he doubting me? What the hell is going on here? Of course I do, including police and FBI records of the harassment. Look, there's no point in continuing this if you're... Your contention is that it started out coming from the families of Melvin Royal's victims? I'm in the act of rising to walk away, but now I sit down again. I hadn't wanted to go there. In fact, I'd told the producer I wouldn't answer questions about the victims or their families. I need to head this off. I don't want to talk about the victims' families. Why not? They were the original people who were angry with you, weren't they? I do not want to blame the families. I can't leave that as the impression. I don't blame people who were dealing with an impossible load of grief and anger. I blame the complete strangers who piled on to satisfy their own needs. Did you bring any examples of this harassment we can show our audience? For the purposes of establishing your case, of course. I feel color burning my cheeks and chin. My case? Am I on trial here? No, I say. I try to keep it calm and level. I didn't, and I wouldn't. They're vile. I believe our producer did ask you to bring some to share, isn't that correct? I'd tried. I'd opened up the file drawer where I kept those awful things, tried to find one that wasn't so personal and horrific that it brought bile to my throat. But I couldn't. Anything less they'd have dismissed as, she's blowing it out of proportion. Anything that was truly horrible, they'd have said it was unsuitable for the air. I decided to protect my children, I say. Many of those messages are about them, and I refuse to make those public. I'm not making their torment into public entertainment. I'm here to tell the truth, not publicize the lies. I feel a brief, shining moment of calm as I say it. I'm in the right, I know I am, and I think the audience knows it too. And then he turns on me. Gwen? He slides a bit forward in his chair, angles toward me, a confessional in the making. Are you aware of the documentary? I feel like the chair is melting underneath me, sinking me into the center of the earth. What documentary? I'm aware of the edge I've put on the word. I can't stop myself. What are you talking about? It's subtle, but I see a little flicker of enthusiasm flash in his eyes. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, there was a video that briefly surfaced that seemed to confirm that you were involved in your ex-husband's case. What fucking documentary? I take a deep breath to calm myself and say, the video was an expert fake, and the FBI has confirmed that fact. You can look up the press release. The fact that there's even a question about this at all just points up the continuing harassment I have to face every day, as do my kids. I'm still trying to turn this disaster around. I can't think what else to do. Well, let's talk about that. Melvin Royal seems to have a significant and growing number of defenders assembling online who believe that either he had no real guilt in this entire crime spree or that you share equal blame. Don't you think those people have a right to express their opinions? I want to smash my fist into his face. I want to scream. I want to run so badly my legs shake with the urge. If their opinions include saying that I should be flayed alive and my children murdered in front of me, then no, I don't. My voice has the force of fury. I swallow a burn in the back of my throat, taste bile. What documentary are you talking about? Yes, that's a perfect opportunity to introduce our other guest today. Mrs. Tidewell, would you please join me? I realized that the people I'd been aware of moving in the background were the bearded microphone handler and the floor director, and as I turned slightly, I see someone new stepping up onto the riser. I know her, and it feels like I'm plunging off the edge of the world. Miranda Tidewell. Rich, connected, and terminally angry. She's got reason to be. Her daughter, Vivian, was my husband's second victim. But since the beginning, she's believed that I shared the blame, that I should have known and stopped him, or that I did it right alongside him. She's been a knife in my back from the moment Melvin was arrested. It was principally her advocacy that made sure I was arrested too, and tried, though the evidence was slim at best, and based on a cracked foundation of perjury by a neighbor. Miranda wanted me on death row alongside Melvin, and from the look she gives me as she steps up to take the third chair, the chair I'd been wondering about, she still does. The contrast between us is stark. While we're both white women, my hair's dark, my clothes plain and serviceable. She has upswept hair the color of pale gold, expensive jewelry, and she's wearing a designer business suit. She looks television ready, down to her pitch-perfect makeup. She doesn't even look at me, though I'm staring at her. She accepts Howie Hamlin's handshake and sits down in the chair with elegance and ease. "Thank you for inviting me to be on this morning, Mr. Hamlin," she says, "and for hearing our side. The families of the victims of Melvin and Gina Royal appreciate your outreach." I need to get up and walk away. She doesn't acknowledge my presence in the slightest. I don't have any idea how to ignore hers. The whole world has taken on an eerie, whispering unreality, as if I've sunk deep into the ocean. "Of course, and the group you represent is called the Lost Angels," she says, "after the children, sisters, mothers, and more distant relatives and friends that were taken from us. I understand that the Lost Angels have come up with the funding to launch the filming of a full documentary that you say will fully explain this case. But with Melvin Royal dead and Ms. Proctor completely exonerated, what benefit do you see coming from this expense?" I want to scream, throw something, get the hell off this stage, but I can't. I need to listen. Howie Hamlin, whether he intends to or not, is doing me a huge favor by alerting me that the Lost Angels, a group I haven't heard from in a long time, is active and working. I'd really thought they'd had enough and moved on with their grief and their lives, but apparently not. "Well, obviously, we're not interested in a new criminal trial. Mrs. Royal was acquitted by a jury of her peers," Miranda says. "What we do believe in is the court of public opinion, which has been so incredibly effective in other miscarriages of justice when the guilty go unpunished. We will be laying out our full case for the public in the form of this new in-depth documentary that goes deep into the life of Gina Royal."
"Is the documentary finished?"
"It's just beginning," Miranda says, and turns her attention suddenly on me. The hatred in her eyes is just exactly the same intensity it was on the day she sat in the courtroom as I was acquitted and released. I haven't seen her since then, but it's like no time has passed at all. This is all so monstrous that for a moment I can't even quite believe what I've heard. I can't move. I can't think. I just stare at this woman, who seems otherwise so normal, and I can't fathom how someone could be this obsessed for years. "You can't do this," I say. "You can't tear my life, the lives of my children, apart like this, again." "I'm not," Miranda says. "I'm simply funding a documentary, which will be released to the internet and film festivals all over the world when we're done. It's a labor of love, if you will, to honor your husband's victims, our children. And I look forward to hearing your opinion, Mrs. Royal. I think you'll quite like the actress we have playing you in the dramatic recreations." She wants a scene. She's here to provoke one. To make me lose my shit and choke her right here on this stage, with Howie Hamlin and half the state of Tennessee as the horrified witnesses. I need to play this game, and play it well. So I sit back. "I'll look forward to it," I say, "and I'll be glad for the chance to put out my own statements correcting any inaccuracies. And as you probably know, not all the family members are on your side." "No," Miranda agrees. I'm afraid some of them believe in your particular brand of victimhood. It's too bad, really. She's probably talking about Sam, but she's being careful. The last thing she wants is to attempt to smear him right now. It would make her look a lot less legitimate and a lot more vindictive. It's too bad that you haven't been able to find a positive way out of your own grief, Mrs. Tidwell, I say, and I mean it. I'm sorry for what happened to your daughter, and I wish you could find peace with the justice that was already served. Her killer is dead. One of them, she snaps. One to go. She recognizes that she's stepped on the line, if not over it, and she makes a conscious effort to put tears in her eyes and put a hand over her mouth. A perfectly overwhelmed, grieving mother, if you're not watching closely. Forgive me, Mr. Hamlin. This is harder than I thought. Are you all right, Mrs. Tidwell? Howie asks, as if he cares. He has tissues at the ready, and she dabs lightly at her eyes, careful not to smudge. If this is too hard for you, we can take a break. What if it's too hard for me? I ask him. I'm aware I'm angry, but I can't out-delicate Miranda Tidwell. She was born to manipulate, and I've never mastered that particular skill. This woman spearheaded a movement to put my life and the lives of my children at risk from forces she has no hope of controlling, and she's threatening to do it again. I'm not threatening anything, Miranda says. Her voice is even trembling. What a brave woman, people at home will be thinking. While I look like an angry, coldly vindictive bitch. I'm just stating that we're making a documentary about our lost loved ones and investigating the full scope of the case. Please bear in mind, ladies, that I'm not taking a side, Howie says, and his tone reminds me of a greasy tub of used lard my grandmother used to keep on the stove. I can't help it. I snap. I don't have a side. I have the truth. I half shouted at him. I can't keep it together anymore. You brought me on this program to talk about the harassment of my family, and instead, you've given time and space to a woman who will do anything to destroy me and my kids. No, you don't get to pretend that's a side. That's not why I came here. Ms. Proctor, no. I stand up, unclip the microphone, yank it down my shirt, and throw the thing into the chair. I want to throw it into his face. I'm done. The camera tracks me as I charge off the riser and out of the glare of the lights. I want to shove the computer-driven machine out of my way, but I'm sure that would mean fines or charges, so I dodge it and head straight for the green room. I slam the door open and look at my two kids. My two beautiful, wonderful children, who are staring at me open-mouthed. There are three other people in the green room now, too. An African-American man and woman, and a white woman, all dressed for camera appearances. The black couple looks distraught and not sure what to make of what just happened. Behind me, Howie Hamlin is apologizing to viewers and promising to continue the interview as soon as Mrs. Tidwell feels able. He cuts to a commercial, leans back to peruse some notes, and says, "Awesome, Mrs. Tidwell, I'll keep you for 2 more minutes, then we'll go to the whites. Aaron, have them ready." The whites. I remember his introduction at the beginning. These, then, must be the parents of Ellie White, the missing 6-year-old. It's been days since she disappeared, driven off by a fake chauffeur in what was evidently a well-planned and professional abduction. "I'm sorry," I tell them, and then wonder if they want anything from me, even sympathy. After that horror show, maybe not. They don't answer. I don't even know if they hear me, really. "What the hell happened?" Lanny finally bursts. Her eyes are huge, her face pale, even under the too pale makeup she still favors. "Mom, is that woman one of the mothers of..." "It's all right, baby," I tell her. "Let's go. Right now." Connor hasn't made a sound, but he comes to me and puts his arm around me. He's had a growth spurt in the past few months, and he comes up to my shoulder now. Lanny's still taller than he is, but not by that much. I want them out of here while Miranda is still on the air, unable to pursue. I nod to the Whites. The woman with them, middle-aged with a utilitarian hairstyle and practical pantsuit, nods back. She studies me as I move my kids out of the green room and grab my bag on the way out the door. I'm dialing my phone before we even hit the outer door. A staffer tries to waylay me, probably to persuade me to go back into the gladiatorial pit of idiocy, and I stiff-arm him out of the way and don't listen to a word he says. Then we're outside, and Sam's picking up on the other end of the phone.
"Done already?" he sounds surprised.
"You weren't watching?"
"I went to get coffee. What happened?"
"Tell you in the car. We'll meet you at the end of the driveway," I say, and we head down the slight slope of the walkway at a good clip. As we do, I see that the giant monitor on the front of the broadcast building is silently playing the Howie Hamlin show, with closed captioning beneath the action. There must be a time delay, because apparently Hamlin is just now apologizing to the audience for my abrupt departure. I'm sure the next step, because Hamlin's staff will have done their homework, is to let Miranda talk about how suspicious my behavior is, about the dead young woman found last year floating in Stillhouse Lake, right outside my front door, about how I got away with murder, except that it wasn't me. It was a man who wanted to frame me at the orders of my ex. Not that they'll ever believe that. I shouldn't have to defend my very existence, my horrible past, the scars on my body and soul. I can't believe I let myself get pulled into doing the show. I've let my kids down. I'm fighting tears, shaking. I thought I was going to end all our problems, and instead I've just made it another sideshow. My phone rings as we round the curve. I see Sam's truck idling down at the end of the sidewalk with his emergency flashers blinking. I answer without taking my eyes off our escape route.
"Yes, Ms. Proctor, this is Dana Reyes, the assistant producer of the Howie Hamlin show. I'm so sorry that came off as such a surprise. We certainly didn't intend for it to be that confrontational."
Liar.
"Please come back to the set. We'll have the next segment set up for you alone, and I promise we'll focus solely on your story."
I practically hear her checking her notes.
"About the stalking of your family. Obviously, we apologize if you felt offended by..."
I hang up on her. We pile into the pickup, and Sam turns the flashers off and pulls into traffic. It's a beautiful afternoon in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hot and clear, the sky an intense blue. Sam is sending me cautious looks. He doesn't want to ask. I don't want to volunteer. The kids are sitting behind us in the extended cab, and they're uncharacteristically quiet, too. Shocked, as I am, that such a nice day has turned so completely toxic. What did I just do? I think. From Howie's lead-in about the conversations on the internet, Miranda's been stirring trouble for a while. I let the onslaught of reporters distract me from keeping track of all the threats out there, and that was my mistake. I didn't know that this was building against me, against us, but I should have. Conspiracy theories have been multiplying insanely for years now, ever more ridiculous and far-fetched. Chemicals in contrails, anti-vaxxers, climate change deniers, and all those are most precious compared to the toxic horror of the 9/11 and school shooting truthers who reduced the worst nightmare of any parent's life to fakery and ripped the survivors' lives apart. Trust Miranda Tidwell to realize that it's just the right environment to destroy us with a minimum of effort. Make a slanted documentary, launch some outrageous claims, find something that feels true about them, and sell it hard and often. The delusional and the emotionally disturbed will find something in it to comfort them. The lazy will rely on it as unlikely but possible. And in a year or two, the lazy will convince themselves, better safe than sorry, and pass it along as truth. She's smart to do it this way. A documentary, even peddling half-truths and lies, has a certain amount of built-in credibility. People will believe it because the same mindset insists that my innocence, my horror and grief, is just an act. That I had to know, be part of it. Because if they had to admit it was real, that they could be vulnerable to the same terrifying, random events that hit me like a wrecking ball, that's far too frightening. Better to fight an imaginary demon than face real ones. The more I think about it, the angrier I get. I do want to go back into the studio, and I want to rip that smug host's ears off with the volume of my yelling. That's a good reason not to go back. Hey, you okay? Sam's voice is quiet, and it steadies me out of the vibrating rage and into something a little less violent. No, I say. It was an on-air ambush. I suppose you know Miranda Tidewell? I see him stiffen. The glance he throws me is wide-eyed and shocked. Holy shit, Sam says. She was in the studio? With you? Absolutely. She's saying the Lost Angels group is making a documentary, I tell him. About me. I suppose they can't avoid dragging you into it, too. Oh my God. Sam looks absolutely wrecked. I wonder if he's met Miranda. He might have, after coming back from Afghanistan. He'd missed my trial and acquittal, so he came into the horror show late in the game. Miranda would have wanted him on her side. And I remember with an uneasy twinge that Sam was on that side for a while. At least the side of those who believed I was guilty. Okay, we need to get out of here and go straight home. If he wants to tell me I told you so, he holds back, for which I'm deeply grateful. He'd warned me not to rely on the goodwill of television personalities. He'd been right. I'd promised the kids a fun day in Knoxville after the show, but I know that ship has sailed. The last thing I want to do is have them vulnerable out in public, with at least some percentage of the city on alert for us after that disaster. Some jerk won't be able to resist the bait, and I am not having my kids harassed. Yes, I agree. Sorry, guys, I know I promised we'd stay the afternoon, but you're looking out for us, Lanny says. Connor, predictably, doesn't say anything. We get it, but Mom, we can handle things. She says that with the absurd confidence of a 15-year-old, and I'm terrified that she means it. Well, I can't handle things right now, I say, because that way I'm not insulting either of them by pretending that they haven't been through hell and back. I know this is a long trip for nothing. I'm sorry. I really didn't see this coming. I should have. If I'd been on guard, watching the internet like I should have. It's okay, my son finally says. We understand. That's sweeter than I deserve. And suddenly I'm even angrier that there are people out there treating us like paper targets. My kids are as real and as incredible as they come, and I will fight for them to the end. Sam says, how about some ice cream for the road? Ice cream, Connor says, suddenly animated. Oreo ice cream. Whatever you want, my dude, Sam says. Lanny? I look into the rearview mirror. She's wrinkling her nose, but she says, sure, a concession. Mom, are we back at DEFCON 1 or what? I don't know, I tell her. Sweetie, I just don't know. But for now, I think we have to be very, very careful. We make the drive back to Stillhouse Lake and our house without incident, though I'm hyper alert for anything. The ice cream is good, and Connor is in an expansive mood after wolfing down both his and half his sister's. I'd worry about his eating habits, but the morning pastry is an anomaly, and my son's metabolism keeps him rail thin anyway. He's putting on height and muscle, a process that's slow now, but I can see that it'll accelerate soon. Good. It's an unfortunate fact of our lives. I need my kids to grow up faster than normal. That's been true since the day our lives blew up. Burn in hell, Melvin. The past few years haven't been easy for Lanny and Connor. Or me. But I'd thought we were easing into some kind of peace, finally. We had Sam, who was as fiercely protective of them as I was, who'd followed me up into the wilderness to win them back. We had a home. We had at least a tentative kind of acceptance from friends and some of the neighbors. But after this, I don't know. I just don't know. Let me out here, I tell Sam. I'll get the mail. You guys get dinner going, okay?
Okay, but you know this means you lose your vote.
You hold my proxy vote, I say. Something healthy?
Boo,
my kids say in chorus. I roll my eyes and wave them on up the hill. I use a pretext of checking the mail, but as I stand there, I pull out my phone and dial. When the answering service picks up on the other end, I tell them I need an immediate callback from Dr. Marks. They're cool and professional, the people in that office. They've heard it all. I suppose I should have put more distress into the message, but Dr. Marks knows me. She'll understand the message. It's only a few minutes later when the call comes. Catherine Marks. Gwen, she says, and as always, her voice is crisp, calm, oddly soothing. How'd the television appearance go today?
Did you watch?
No, I'm afraid I couldn't. I had clients.
Well,
I shift a little, reluctant to admit it now that I'm actually on the phone with her.
Not well. I had the thing we talked about.
You reacted to the camera.
Yes.
Paradoxically, the second I admit it, all the memories come tumbling back. I thought I was past this, though Dr. Marks had warned me that this particular kind of post-traumatic stress might keep rebounding on me. It goes deep. That day and night at Kilman Creek, I'd believed, really believed, that I was going to die as Melvin Royal's victim. Tortured to death for an audience paying to see it happen. And all of it, happening in front of the unblinking eye of a video camera.
I kept seeing it all over again. I couldn't control it.
Do you want to come see me?
I can't,
I say. What I mean is, I don't want to. I want to hide here, at home, with my family.
I was hoping you might be able to just
talk you through it, she finishes, just a little wryness in the tone. You've been remarkably reluctant to dig deep into this. Are you saying you're ready to do that now?
Yes,
I say. What I really mean is, no, or I don't know if I can. I close my eyes. The breeze is warm and damp as it rushes over me, and I breathe in slowly, then out in a rush. I open the door to the memory, and the first thing I see is my ex-husband, Melvin Royal, lying next to me, smiling at me as I wake up. I'm there. I feel the crowding, heavy Louisiana humidity, smell the rotting wood of the house. The damp, stiff nightgown sticking to my skin belongs to a dead woman. I feel the shackles biting into my wrists.
No. No.
Gwen? I open my mouth. Nothing comes out. I turn from the memory, shove it deep, slam a mental door and lock it with a cartoonishly large imaginary padlock. But I still see his Cheshire cat grin and the glassy dead eye of the camera watching me. I watched him beat a woman to death, beat her until there was nothing left of her. I can't go back there.
I'm sorry,
I tell her. My voice sounds small and defeated.
I can't.
It's all right, Dr. Mark says. You pushed too fast. Let it go. Step back. Listen to your heartbeat. Breathe. You don't have to do this until you're ready, and you'll feel it. Until then, you need to protect yourself from something that hurts. There's no shame in that. I do as she says. I'm almost panting, but as I slow down, I'm back here at Stillhouse Lake. The air is familiar. The fresh smell of the trees cuts the memory of rancid decay.
I open my eyes and stare at the peaceful, soft ripples of the lake. I'm not there. But in a way, I never left. Maybe I'm not ready to leave it behind yet.
I'm sorry, I tell her again. I thought I could do it today. But I almost lost it.
Almost, she says. But you didn't. You need to forgive yourself for human weakness. No one's strong all the time. I need to be, though. I have enemies just as much now as ever. Strength is the only thing that stands between those faceless threats and my children. I make an appointment with her in 2 weeks. We'll sit for an hour, and I'll try to get this poison out of me. But today's not the day. When I hang up, it's not quite sundown, just a shady late afternoon, and I enjoy the silence for a minute before I head to the mailbox standing at the bottom of the drive. It's painted a cheery yellow with flowers on the lid, and though the kids wanted to put our names on it, I told them no, very firmly. I let them sign the work with their initials. I figured that was a compromise. I focus on the painting, on the peace it represents, and I tell myself that I'll get through this. I pull the door down and see a blur just before I hear a rattling hiss. Instinct makes me jump back just before the snake strikes. I take several fast, stumbling steps away. Snakes can reach almost their full body length, and this one misses me by a few inches, retracts, and begins to slither angrily into a knot inside the box. A snake in my mailbox. I try to control my racing heartbeat and instant shakes. It's a nasty-looking bastard, mottled gray and brown like the forest floor, with the distinctive head of some kind of viper. I don't know snakes, but I know if they rattle, it can't be good. I don't know if I've let out a scream. Probably. I dial the Norton police officer I know best, Kezia Claremont, one of the few people I trust with my kids, and must reach her in the car, because her voice comes in close and tinny, rumbled by road noise.
Hey, Gwen, what's up?
There's a snake in my mailbox. My voice sounds remarkably flat. I think it's some kind of rattlesnake.
What?
Rattlesnake. In my mailbox. I glance around and grab a fallen branch that's lying nearby, making sure I look for any friends the snake might have first. I use the stick to flip the door of the mailbox shut, trapping the snake inside. And then I begin to wonder if this branch might have already been used for this very purpose. Too late to worry about fingerprints, if that was even possible to get from rough wood.
My kids could have opened that, Kez. Jesus Christ!
Is it poisonous?
It rattled!
Are you bitten?
No, I don't think so.
Now that the adrenaline is starting to recede, I feel sick and woozy. I check my hands and arms for any bites, but I'm clean.
I'm okay, but someone needs to come get this thing out.
Okay, here's what I want you to do. Keep that box shut. Tape it shut if you need to. I'm sending a specialist to come get it. There's a pause. The road noise lessens. You think someone put it in there? Deliberately? The box was shut when I got here, Kez, and the mail was inside. That snake arrived after the mail. Unless vipers have figured out how to close doors behind them, it sure didn't seal itself in there on its own. Kezia is quiet after that for a few seconds. I hear clicks. She switched over to texting. I can hear the distraction in her voice as she replies.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. I've got the snake guy and forensics dispatched. As soon as the snake's gone, forensics is going to process that mailbox. If we're lucky, somebody's left us a print.
I can't imagine anyone fool enough to do that, but she's right. It's worth a shot.
Okay, I tell her.
I'll wait here until they arrive.
I'm on my way.
Lanny comes back down the hill as the vivid blue sky fades to faint orange above me, and the trees give up their daytime green and become sharp black points. The wind's died down, and the lake is still. Most of the boats are gone. I'm standing 6 feet from the mailbox, and I don't take my eyes off it.
Mom?
Lanny says. Go back in the house, I tell her. I'm staring at the mailbox, maybe a little obsessively. I'll be there in a bit. I'm waiting for someone. Okay. She doesn't know exactly what I'm doing or what to ask. Should I go ahead and start the chicken or what? Yes, I tell her. Go ahead. Thanks, honey. Okay. She doesn't leave. Mom, are you okay? I'm fine. She frowns at me. Honey, I need some time, okay? I need to work through some things. You go on. Tell Sam I'm okay. Because I know Sam will be down here next. She knows damn well I'm not telling the whole truth. And I'm not. Because I need to keep her safe. But she goes, finally. I like that instinct in her, to question everything. It will serve her well in the future, even with me. And I'm glad she didn't stay. I'm very aware, hideously aware, as night begins to fall, that I'm standing out here alone, exposed, and a snake in my mailbox is hardly the only threat out there. What if the person who put it there comes back? What if they're behind me right now? I give in. I take a fast look around as my daughter heads up the hill. No one around. No threats I can see. But it doesn't mean they aren't there. Waiting. Chapter 2. Gwen. The man arrives first about 10 minutes later. He's a rough specimen who looks like he's just spent weeks out in the woods, and I don't like it. Or him. Or any of this. He says, Hey, I'm here for that snake. ID, I say. He blinks. What? Show me some ID. I don't know you, and I'm armed. I've set my feet in a solid fighting stance, centered my weight, and loosened my knees. I don't know if he recognizes that, but he eyes me warily. I wonder if he's thinking I'm paranoid. Well, he'd be right. Okay. He holds up both hands. Sure. Reaching for ID, okay? Slowly. He does, never taking his eyes off me. He reaches back behind him, and I'm bluffing about the gun, because I've left it in the goddamn truck's locked glove compartment, and right now I'm kicking myself for that. But when his hand reappears, slowly, it's holding a wallet. He opens it and pulls out a thick white business card. On the ground, I tell him. He crouches and puts it down halfway between us, as far as he can reach. I step over and pick it up in one quick, fluid dip, then raise it so I can read it while still watching him. It's a nice one. Pure white with official black lettering and raised ink. Professor Greg Maynard. He works for the University of Tennessee. Goes to show. You can't judge a woodsy hermit by his looks. He's a full tenured professor of biology. How odd. Snake? He asks again. I point to the mailbox. Sorry about that, I tell him. I don't know who did this. You understand? Maybe it was just meant as a joke. Open it. He gets a cotton sack and a stick with a hook on the end and flips the box open. The snake strikes. The professor doesn't even flinch, but then he's standing at the exact safe distance. Timber rattler, he says. Wow, cool. You were lucky, and that is definitely not a joke. Not a good one, anyway. I watch, fascinated, as he coaxes the snake out of the mailbox, and it winds down the metal pole of the box to the dirt. From there, he efficiently pins the snake down just behind the head and picks it up barehanded with an amount of calm I find amazing. The snake rattles and thrashes a bit, but it goes into the bag and he cinches it shut and ties it securely. I almost let my guard down until it runs through my mind that it would take someone with these exact skills to put a timber rattler in the mailbox. Are those local around here? I ask him. He nods. Sure, out in the woods. Sometimes I find one of them down this far, but it's not too normal. We see more cottonmouths and copperheads around the water.
Maynard's thorough. He examines the inside of the mailbox with the light of his cell phone before saying,
"Okay, you're clear. I'll get this little beauty back to my lab."
"Lab," I repeat.
"I'm a herpetologist. I milk snakes. That's how we make the antivenin," he says. "There's always a demand for it out here in the country. You see any more of them, or any other kind of viper for that matter, you give me a call. I'll find him a good home back in the woods where he won't bother anyone once we're done with him."
I nod, still not taking my eyes off him. Professor or not, he's now my primary suspect. Though what the hell he'd get out of scaring the shit out of me, or seeing me bitten, I have no idea. He doesn't seem to have any personal grudge. I'm not getting any vibe like that from him at all. He's loading the snake into his truck when the forensics team, well, one middle-aged guy in a baggy windbreaker, rolls up in an old Jeep. The forensics guy shows me ID without me asking for it, in a move so natural, he probably does it in his sleep. Speaking of that, he looks dog-tired, but he asks me intelligent questions and writes things down, and he's dusting the mailbox for fingerprints when Kezia Claremont pulls up just a couple of minutes after. She's driving her personal car without the lights and sirens, and I'm glad about that. Our neighbors are surely already gawking at the parade of activity. I'd rather not give them more to gossip about, if possible. "Hey, Beto," Kez says to the forensics guy, and he waves without looking up. She's still wearing what I think of as her work clothes, a plain navy pantsuit and a white blouse, with her detective shield clipped to her waistband. Gun concealed under her jacket. If she's been home already, she'd have swapped out for jeans and a comfortable t-shirt. "Snake's gone, I guess. Off to a happy home, according to," I check the business card, "Professor Maynard. What do you know about him?"